So it's an honor and a pleasure to give a talk here for the Bootstrap Workshop. Of course, as a member of the It From Qubit collaboration, I feel a little bit like a traitor giving a talk for the enemies, but I guess I'll just have to get over that. I'm going to talk about some work in progress, hopefully to appear soon, with Scott Collier, who's here and to whom you should address all questions, along with Henry Maxfield and Yannis Tsiaras. This is going to be a talk about two-dimensional conformal field theory. And from my point of view and the point of view of this talk, a 2D CFT is defined by a set of data. So it's defined by a list of primary operators. Along with two pieces of data about these primary operators. So we need to know their dimensions and their spins, which I'm writing in terms of left and right moving dimensions h and h bar. And we need to know the three-point function coefficients or the OPE coefficients for these primary operators. And once I have this data, these dimensions, spins, and OPE coefficients, all of the CFT observables are completely defined. All the correlation functions of arbitrary operators in the theory on an arbitrary surface can be determined in terms of this data. And of course, ideally, if we were to solve the bootstrap problem for 2D CFTs, then we would come up with just a list of the allowed CFT data, the dimensions and OPE coefficients. But of course, that's a very tall order. So instead, the question that we'd like to ask is, what features of this data are universal, that is to say, true in any conformal field theory, as opposed to which features are theory dependent? So let's just start by thinking of what kinds of universal features these data might obey. So examples of universal features. So here we're talking about compact unitary conformal field theories. And every compact unitary CFT has an identity operator, which is spinless and scale invariant. So h and h bar are equal to zero. So that's one example of a universal feature. Another example is Cardy's formula, which says that very heavy operators have a density of states given by Cardy's formula. So this is a universal formula in the sense that it depends only on the central charge and not on any other CFT data. So that's another example of a universal feature. And in fact, although it's not a priori obvious just looking at these formulas, these are in fact two different manifestations of the same thing. These two universal features are dual in the sense that they are related by modular invariants. Okay, so what's another universal feature of any conformal field theory that we could write down? Well, we said that every CFT that we're studying has an identity operator, and the OPE coefficients of any two operators with the identity are equal to one. And in particular, the OPE of the identity operator with itself, the C identity, identity, identity is equal to one. So that's another universal feature of any CFT. So that then begs the question, if I'm using that phrase correctly, if here we had two universal features of any CFT that are dual to one another, a statement about the low energy behavior of the theory dual to a statement about the high energy behavior of the theory, here we have another low-energy universal statement about any conformal field theory. So the question then is, what is its dual? And that's the question that I'd like to answer today. So the answer is a universal formula for the asymptotic values of the OPE coefficients. In particular, it's a universal formula for the average value of the square of the OPE coefficients. It's given by a complicated formula, sufficiently complicated that I went and I wrote it ahead of time. But you should think of it as a version of Cardy's formula, where the average value of the square of the OPE coefficient for heavy operators takes this form. So the details of this formula are not something that we need to dwell on too much. So here you'll see that rather than writing things in terms of the central charge and the dimensions h and h bar, I've written everything in terms of what we usually refer to as the Liouville parameters. So instead of central charge, I use this parameter q, or alternately, this parameter b. And instead of the conformal dimension h, I'll either use alpha or I'll use a variable p. Okay? P is sometimes that what we would usually call the Liouville momentum. So for a very heavy operator, namely one whose dimension is bigger than c minus 1 over 24, p will be a real number, and in particular, a large real number. Whereas for light operators, those with dimension less than c minus 1 over 24, p would be imaginary. Good. And everything here is defined in terms of this Barnes double gamma function, whose form is not going to be terribly important for us. We just can remember that just as the gamma function is defined as the mirror morphic function with no zeros and poles at the negative integers, this Barnes double gamma function is defined as the mirror morphic function with no zeros and poles at negative integer linear combinations of B and B inverse. So I won't need any other properties of that function. Good. It is almost the DOZZ three-point coefficient. So yes, good. I'm going to comment on that in a minute. But yes, since the question was asked, up to a normalization factor, this is the DOZZ formula. It's not literally the DOZZ formula because, among other things, I'm working with compact unitary CFDs, whereas in Liouville theory, we don't have a discrete spectrum. The identity operator is not normalizable. So the difference between this and the DOZZ formula is basically the normalization, the way that we normalize our operator. Good. And so if you like, you could think of this statement over here as the statement that Liouville theory is somehow reproducing the asymptotics of heavy operators in an arbitrary two-dimensional conformal field theory. Although we're not going to be using Liouville theory in this talk today. Good. But before I dive into any details, let me just unpack exactly what I mean by this formula right here. Because really, although I've written a single formula here, this is actually secretly three different formulas hiding in one expression. Because in particular, this formula 4 holds in three separate limits. So when we talk about the asymptotics of OPE coefficients, one thing that we could mean is that we're holding two of the operators fixed and taking one of the operators heavy. Another thing that we could mean is that we're holding one of the operators fixed and taking two of the operators to be heavy. And the third thing that we could mean is that we're taking all of the operators to be heavy. And in particular, this asymptotic formula holds in all three cases. And in particular, it holds in these three cases where we hold the light operator as fixed and we average over the heavy operators. So in particular, there's one formula where you take the operators I and j to be fixed, what I've called light. You take the k operator to be heavy, and this bar here means averaging over that heavy operator. And then there's a second formula where we hold I fixed, j and k are taken to be heavy, we average over those. And then there's a third formula where we take all of them to be heavy and average over them. Okay? So it's secretly three different formulas, but they all happen to take exactly the same functional form, which is a function only of the central charge, in the same sense that Cardy's formula is only a function of the central charge, as well as the dimensions of the operators appearing, in the same way that Cardy's formula depends on the energy of the heavy state that you're studying. Yes?
If we wrote Cardy's formula...
Yes, it's right above it. Okay.
If we wrote Cardy's formula using those cinches,
yes,
we would, in a sense, be writing too much, because that's... there's subleading terms in there that aren't true.
Okay, so this is the leading piece, and this is an... So usually when we talk about Cardy's formula, we talk about the Cardy formula for all states, not just for primary states. So this is the version of the density of states for primaries. But as you said, it includes lots of other corrections.
Including some corrections that just aren't true in general CFTs, right?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. So this is an asymptotic formula that is true when p is large. I've written it in this form for reasons that'll become clear later
on. But is it also true of the second formula that there's really some, it's really some limit of that formula?
Absolutely.
That's a true formula,
absolutely.
And this is just a handy way
absolutely.
To write it?
Absolutely. This is a handy way of writing it because maybe I can comment on this. So there have been various papers that have been written about these three different cases. And the techniques that you would use to derive asymptotic behavior of OPE coefficients in these three different cases are different techniques. Right? They're different kinds of modular invariance or crossing symmetry. But this universal formula that I've written down reproduces all of the other results in the literature. And in retrospect, the reason why all those results looked different is an order of limits issue. It's about which operators you're taking to be large compared to what and compared to the central charge and stuff like that. And in particular, that brings me to another point, which is I said that these two facts, universal facts about conformal field theory, are dual. So what exactly do I mean by dual? Well, I mean three different things in these three different cases. So here, for the light-heavy OPE coefficients, they're dual in the sense that they're related by crossing symmetry of four-point functions. In the second case, they're dual in the sense that they're related by crossing symmetry and modular invariance for a torus two-point function. And in the heavy-heavy case, they are dual in the sense that they're related by modular invariance of the CFT on a genus 2 Riemann surface. And a priori, it might appear surprising that arguments based on these three different types of crossing symmetry or modular invariance give you the exact same answer. But when we actually go about constructing this, you'll see that due really to results that go back to Moore and Seiberg, in retrospect, it had to be the case that you get the same asymptotic formula using these three different types of crossing symmetry. Good. The other comment that I'll make is that the previous versions of this formula that have appeared in the literature are true at large central charge. In particular, they're either formulas that were written down for the average over all states in the theory, which is interpreted as an average over primary states only in the limit of large central charge. But this is a formula that's true at finite central charge. So as long as the central charge is bigger than one, so that we have an infinite number of primary states in the theory, this formula will be true. And this is really a formula for the average averaged over primary operators rather than all operators in the theory. Good. Okay, and please feel free to interrupt and ask questions if anything is unclear. So before I go into any detail. By the way, how much time do I have? Is this an hour long? 2 hours, right? No, it's a 1 hour long talk. Okay, and I started at around 11:45. Okay, great. Okay, so before we get into any details, let me just give you a cartoon of the way that this calculation will work. So let's imagine that we wanted to study a four-point function. And I would like to study this four-point function in two different ways. So first, I'd like to study it by expanding in terms of intermediate operators in the S channel. And then I'd like to compare that to an expansion in the T channel. So this, for example, would be an expansion in terms of intermediate operators in the S channel. And we wish to compare that to an expansion in terms of intermediate operators in a T channel. Which, of course, is related to an expansion in the S channel by x going to 1 minus x. The S channel is the one where we take these two operators close to one another. The T channel is the one where we take these two operators to be close to one another. And then we want to determine the asymptotics of the OPE coefficients in the S channel by demanding that you reproduce a pole coming from the identity operator in the T channel. So in particular, the pole at x equals 1 determines the asymptotic behavior of the S-channel OPE coefficients. And how does it do that? Well, an easy way of thinking about that, and indeed what we'll be doing essentially later on in this talk, is just by thinking about the contribution coming from the pole of the identity operator in the T channel. Okay, so there, this is equal to 0, and you just get a pole of order 2, 8 times to the dimension of the external operator. And let's just imagine thinking about this expanded in terms of these powers that appear in the S channel. So there's some expansion coefficient, which is a binomial coefficient that I've written here. And demanding that we reproduce this pole at x equals 1 means that asymptotically, these coefficients must approach this binomial coefficient. So in particular, the average value of C external external S channel state squared must be approximately equal to that binomial coefficient. Good. Now, what I'd like to do is give a very fancy name to this binomial coefficient, because what am I doing here? What I've done here is I've organized the states of my theory into scaling blocks. That is to say, I'm weighting each power here by the scaling dimension. And in this formula, I've taken the scaling block in the T channel for the identity operator and expanded it in terms of scaling blocks for the S operator in the S channel. And what we see is that the asymptotic behavior of the OPE coefficients in the S channel is precisely the thing that you get when you expand the T channel identity block in terms of the S channel. So the name that we give for a block in one channel expanded in terms of blocks in another channel is a crossing kernel. And what this argument tells us is that the crossing kernel, where one operator is the identity, is the asymptotic behavior of the OPE coefficient. And in order to derive this formula here, all we're going to do is make that same argument for Virasoro blocks instead of for scaling blocks. So that was just a cartoon over there. But this already has all of the features that we're going to be using. We're just going to replace these scaling blocks by Vera's Oroblongs. And in particular, this also demonstrates one additional interesting feature, which is that these crossing kernels are exceptionally simple. The binomial coefficients predated the invention of calculus by 7 centuries, okay? So that's evidence that they're simple objects, simple compared to any fancy conformal blocks or something like that. And indeed, the reason that we're able to write down an asymptotic formula like this is that even though we don't know analytic formulas for the conformal blocks that we're interested in, we do have analytic formulas for the corresponding crossing kernels. And this is the formula. In the same way that the asymptotic behavior of this guy, of this coefficient, is the corresponding crossing kernel, this is the crossing kernel that we're going to be interested in. And indeed, as we'll see, it's essentially the crossing kernel both for 4-point crossing, torus 2-point crossing, and genus 2 modular crossing. So let me just say that a little bit more explicitly, just defining a few terms, okay? So what we want to do more generally is we want to imagine that we expand a general correlation function or partition function in terms of some intermediate operators. So we have we're expanding in terms of some intermediate operators times some conformal block. And we wish to compare that to an expansion in a different channel. So in this other channel, there will be some other OPE data that enters, and there will be some conformal blocks in this other channel. Okay. So here, these are the OPE coefficients that correspond to the channel decomposition of whatever observable I'm talking about. They depend on the data of the theory, the spectrum of the OPE coefficients, whereas these conformal blocks are going to be purely kinematic objects. And what we want to do is imagine expanding the conformal blocks in one channel in terms of conformal blocks in a dual channel. And the expansion coefficients are what we will call the crossing kernel. And here, I'm working with Vera's Oroblongs, not just scaling blocks. So then, the name of the game is to find a limit of the parameter Q, which could be the modulus of some Riemann surface, or it could be the cross ratio of some correlation function. So you find a limit where the identity dominates in one channel, and then you want to expand that in the other channel and see what you get. So if there's a limit where the identity dominates, then in this first expression, the OPE coefficient involving the identity operator is just 1. So you're just left with a conformal block for the identity. And then you use your definition of the crossing kernel to expand in terms of data in the cross channel. And you compare this expression to this expression. And what do you see? Well, you then see that this crossing kernel is just the asymptotic behavior of this OPE coefficient. So in particular, the crossing kernel, where one operator is the identity, is the product of 2 things. So first, you have to go from an integral over dimensions to a sum over all states. So you need a factor of the density of states here. And then you have the average value of whatever combination of OPE coefficients, now for heavy operators, appeared in the cross channel. So the reason why, so this is really exactly the same argument that I've given over here, but I've gone through it in a slightly more abstract manner just to emphasize that, first of all, the only thing that you need to find is a limit where the identity operator dominates in whatever CFT observable you're interested in. So today I'll talk about a few simple CFT observables, but there are many others that you could think about. And then once you do so, you automatically get a universal formula. And it's universal in the sense that it only depends on the central charge, right? Because these conformal blocks are purely kinematic objects. Hence, this crossing kernel is a purely kinematic object. Hence, this crossing kernel with the identity is a kinematic object that only depends on the central charge and the dimensions of whatever heavy states you have involved. Okay. Yes?
That last step where you equate C tilde to S, we believe that when F tilde is positive.
Good. Good. Great. Good question. So So the degree of precision to which you can make these statements really depends on, first of all, you can make these statements in complete rigor when the coefficients appearing in this expansion are positive definite. Okay? So in that case, you know, I've written everything. I've written lots of squiggly lines, and I've been a little imprecise about what I mean by average. The precise thing that you would want to do is invoke a Tauberian theorem, and that would be the sort of mathematically rigorous version of these statements. You know, it turns out that rigorously you get bounds not on things like densities of states, but integrated densities of states. In this talk, I'm going to be sloppy. I'm not going to talk about any Tauberian theorems, but of course, that would be interesting to do so. In particular, when I say average, what I need to do is I need to average over some window, and I'm not going to tell you how large that window is, because that the size of that window will typically depend on what theory you're talking about. So for example, in a chaotic theory, where all OPE coefficients are probably about the same, so you would need to average over a very small window. But in an integrable theory, most OPE coefficients are going to be zero because of conservation laws. And so this average will be attained, but it'll be obtained by averaging a bunch of things that are zero and something that's very large. And so you need to average over a very wide window. And exactly how wide that window needs to be is something that you would need to use a Tauberian theorem to understand. So if I remember correctly, for Cardi's formula, the window needs to be size 1. Remember correctly. But in a typical theory, it will actually be exponentially small. Right. So understanding the precise version of this in terms of a Tauberian theorem is, I think, intimately related to chaos and understanding the distinction between integrable and chaotic theories.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll be considering crossing equations where that OPE data on the right-hand side is manifested.
Absolutely. Yeah. If I didn't say that, I should have said that. Yeah, I mean, you can try and apply this, for example, to things like torus one-point functions where the OPE data that's appearing is just not positive definite. And then this is a much looser statement that's true on average, but average could be some very sloppily defined thing. Good. Great, thank you. Okay. Good. So let's just see how this works in practice. Yeah, I have plenty of time. So let's begin by revisiting the Cardi formula. So for the Cardi formula is derived by thinking about modular invariants on the torus. So if you think about the partition function of a CFT on the torus, you expand that in terms of conformal blocks. But in this case, the conformal blocks are just the Virasoro characters on the torus. So we have an identity character and then a sum over all primary states in the theory times the appropriate Virasoro character. And the formula for these Virasoro characters, well, it's pretty complicated. You know, it involves this Dedekind data function. That's something that nobody likes to study. But fortunately, and this again is one of the important points that I want to emphasize, the crossing kernel is exceptionally simple, even though the conformal blocks, that is to say the Virasoro characters, are not. In particular, it turns out you can expand one of these Virasoro characters in terms of Virasoro characters in a cross channel. So here I'm going to use alpha and p as my momentum variables, or as my dimension variables defined over there. And then we have a crossing kernel. But what is that crossing kernel? Well, the crossing kernel is literally just a Fourier transform. So it's just the cosine of 4 pi p times p prime. So what is the lesson that we want to draw from this? The lesson is that the Virasoro characters are things you have to read about in books on number theory, but the crossing kernels are not. So the Virasoro characters are these complicated Dirichlet Dedekind eta functions, whereas the crossing transformation is literally just a Fourier transform. So that is really the basic lesson, which is that the crossing kernel is much simpler than the corresponding conformal block. In the present case, life on the torus is simple enough that I can still write down the conformal blocks exactly. But once you consider more complicated observables, that's no longer the case. But you can write down the corresponding crossing kernel exactly. And indeed, that's what we've written down over here. Good. And of course, from this, you can derive the sort of crossing or the crossing version of Cardi's formula. So just using this argument over here, we see that the crossing kernel of the identity is just found by evaluating this for the identity operator. So remember, the identity is a light operator, so p is imaginary rather than real. This cosine becomes a cosh. And then there's a small correction that you have to include coming from the fact that this product starts at n equals 2 rather than n equals 1 for the identity. And when you do that, you get this formula that I've written over here. So this is the version of Cardi's formula that you would derive from this argument. So this is otherwise known as the crossing of the identity operator for the torus partition function. Good. And what I'm going to do is now consider more complicated types of crossing and eventually work our way up to things like crossing at genus 2 and for correlation functions on the torus. Okay, so let's revisit our calculation of four-point functions, now organizing in terms of conformal blocks, Virasoro blocks, rather than scaling blocks.
I have a question. So since you get that formula.
Yes.
So I got a bit confused. So we know that some parts of this formula we cannot believe. Like subleading terms.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, how do you know which part of the formula you can believe and which part you can't believe?
I would say it is the same status as Cardi's formula. I mean, you know, we believe it for very heavy states. The rigorous
part,
version.
Which part, like for example, order one coefficient you would believe?
Yes. So in general, I think this formula is true up to exponentially subleading corrections.
Well, how do you know? What if that formula is like has some bigger and bigger oscillations so that on average?
Okay.
I don't understand. Like,
yeah. So as
how
I
do you know? What is that?
Well, I mean, as I said, you know, what you really need to do is write down the Tauberian version of this formula, which is a formula for the integrated version. So that's the thing that you rule out in the case of Cardi's formula. So, you know, I would say that this formula is just as true as Cardia's formula.
Yeah, but it's a much more complicated formula.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And even for the leading term, you should really rigorously write it in terms of some integrated quantity, right? You know, as you did and as other people have done.
But these Weberian theorems are of a kind which may not even exist to this day.
Yet. Invitation, okay? Good. Okay, any other questions? Great. So let's revisit the crossing symmetry of four-point functions. So let's imagine that we're studying some four-point function. And we want to expand in an S channel, now multiplying by the appropriate conformal block. And we want to compare that to an expansion in a T channel, okay, where we take X O2 close to O3 rather than O1, so we get 3 2 S and S 1 4 times an appropriate conformal block. And then we want to define a crossing kernel that relates S channel blocks to T-channel blocks. So this crossing kernel will depend not just on the dimensions of these internal operators, S and T, but also the dimensions of these external operators. I've written that correctly. And again, we wish to study the asymptotics by determining this crossing kernel for the identity operator. So in particular here, I've written the most general possible four-point function. But you can see from this expression that if you want to consider the asymptotic value of an OPE coefficient squared, what you need to do is take operator 3 equal to operator 1, operator 4 equal to operator 2. So I'll take O1, O2, O1, O2 as my correlation function, so that the OPE coefficients that appear will be a sum of OPE coefficients 1, 2, S squared times an appropriate conformal block. And you'll get the same OPE coefficient 1, 2, T squared in the T channel. And then one just needs to compute the corresponding four-point crossing kernel, now with the operators identified in pairs. And fortunately, Ponceau and Teschner gave an expression for this crossing kernel, I believe, almost 20 years ago. And it's a complicated expression, but it turns out to be relatively simple to evaluate in the case where the exchanged operator in the T channel is the identity. And what is the answer? Well, the answer is precisely the expressions that we wrote down over there. In particular, you get one factor of this Cardi density of states times the OPE coefficient, okay? Which is why we identify that function C with the average value of this OPE coefficient squared. Good. And this is the argument that determines the asymptotic behavior in the limit where two of the operators are held fixed and one of them is taken to be heavy. And I should mention here, of course, the great paper of Scott, Jan Gobet, Henry Maxfield and Eric Perlmutter, who studied this in the context of what they called Virazoro mean field theory. And indeed, this OPE coefficient is what you would call the OPE coefficient of their Virasoro mean field theory. Good. So, yes. Yes, which is the limit where x goes to 1, because there you're dominated by the identity operator and the t-channel. So I'm being a little sloppy here. There's x bars floating around everywhere. If you like, you can think of this as an absolute value squared of a left times a right moving block. So for the purposes of this talk, we don't need to worry too much about x and x bar being varied independently. Although, of course, that would be really interesting to say more about.
So this is average over space?
Yes. Yes. Although I think one can make statements where you vary x and x bar separately. This is closely related to this light cone modular bootstrap. At this point, I think I might not say any more about that in the interest of trying to get to the higher genus and all that stuff. Yeah, and you commented on that. So you guys commented on that as well in your Virasoro mean field theory paper.
So will you get an extended regime of average three-point functions if it depends on the twist gap?
That's right. So you would need to make additional assumptions such as the existence of a twist gap.
But then
you
can get,
absolutely.
More about the average three-point.
Absolutely. Okay, so this crossing kernel for four-point functions on the sphere is the first of what I would like to call the elementary crossing kernels. And our crossing kernels for all the other CFT observables are going to be built out of this crossing equation for four operators on the sphere, along with a crossing equation for one-point functions on the torus. Okay. So similarly, one can study crossing for one-point functions on the torus. So, for example, you could consider the one-point function of some operator on the torus. Because the torus is translational invariant, it doesn't depend on the location at which I insert that operator. It's a function only of the modular parameter of the torus. And you could imagine, so the picture that you want to keep in mind is that you have some one-point function on the torus, and the two channels that we're thinking about are an S channel versus a T channel. So this is the S operator, that's the T channel. So you can expand in terms of conformal blocks for one-point functions on the torus and compare that to the expansion of the same object in terms of a T-channel conformal block. And then these will be related by some crossing kernel. So we expand the T-channel, S-channel conformal blocks in terms of the T-channel conformal blocks, just as we did for the four-point function. And these coefficients are the crossing transformations, the crossing kernel for torus one-point functions, which were also computed by Ponceau and Teschner a little less than 20 years ago. And then, you could use this, if you wanted to, for example, to determine the asymptotic behavior of these OPE coefficients not squared in terms of the exchange of the lightest operator in the T-channel. So in that case, what you would get is a formula that is not universal, because when you have an operator here that's not the identity, the identity operator does not contribute in the T-channel. But you would still, nevertheless, get an asymptotic formula for the behavior of these coefficients in terms of whatever lightest operator is exchanged in this channel. So this formula has been written down before at large central charge, but now we would be able to write it down at finite central charge. But I don't want to dwell on that in too much detail, because instead, my goal here today, at least, is to write down some universal formulas. And because the identity operator will not contribute in the T channel, we wouldn't get a universal formula like that. You would get something that relates the heavy OPE data to the light OPE data, but it wouldn't be universal. Good. In particular, I am only going to be, it turns out that I will only need the case where this external operator is the identity, in which case the crossing transformation just reduces to the crossing transformation for the torus. And so this function here, when that operator is the identity, will, when the T-channel operator is the identity as well, just be given by this Cardy formula. So these two conformal blocks, the conformal crossing kernels, the crossing kernel for four-point functions on the sphere and the crossing kernel for one-point functions on the torus, are the things that I'll refer to as the elementary conformal blocks. And then I'm going to use a remarkable fact of Moore and Seiberg, which is that every crossing kernel can be built as a product of these elementary crossing kernels. So what is the idea? The idea is that we think of a CFT correlation function on a surface, let's call it sigma, and we represent that as some sort of punctured Riemann surface. And then the idea is that each pair of Pant's decomposition of this Riemann surface of this punctured Riemann surface, I should say, corresponds to a channel decomposition of the corresponding CFT correlation function with an OPE coefficient for each pair of Pant's. So for example, what I want to do if I wanted to consider, say, four-point crossing, I imagine starting with a sphere with four punctures that I've represented by cutting little holes out of that Riemann surface there. And I think of a pair of Pant's decomposition. Right? So for example, I could cut the surface here to think of this four-punctured sphere as two pairs of Pant's glued together. And you should think of this as the S-channel decomposition of our sphere four-point function. Now, of course, there are many ways that this Riemann surface can be represented as pairs of Pant's glued together. And those different ways of representing this Riemann surface as pairs of Pant's glued together are precisely the different channel decompositions of this CFT amplitude. Okay? And in particular, these different channels are related by the action of the mapping class group, or the modular group of this Riemann surface. And in particular, this mapping class group is generated by the two elementary mappings, namely four-point crossing on the sphere and one-point crossing on the torus. So Moore and Seiberg used this to argue that any CFT which is invariant under crossing symmetry of four-point functions on the sphere and one-point functions on the torus is necessarily modular invariant and crossing symmetric for any observable or any amplitude. But this also gives us an explicit construction of the corresponding crossing kernels. Because each crossing transformation just corresponds to some element of the mapping class group. And they told us how to build up elements of the mapping class group as products of these elementary operations. Okay. So this gives the crossing kernels for this very general crossing transformation as a product of the elementary crossing transformations. So I only have about 5 minutes left. So what I'd like to do is just show you how this works in one example. So let's consider the example of a torus two-point function. So consider the two-point function of some operator on the torus. And let's think about the various different ways that we could write this as sums over intermediate operators. So one thing that we could do is we could OPE these two guys together to get a one-point function on the torus, and then sum over all the operators that can propagate around the torus. Okay? So that's something that we might denote using a diagram like this. So here, I'm taking my operators O close to get to, I'm expanding the OO two-point function in terms of intermediate operators that I've called 2 prime here. And then I have an operator 1 prime that runs around the torus. So I've got this OPE coefficient there times some corresponding conformal block. So we could call this the conformal block in the OPE channel. And I want to compare that to a different decomposition of my torus two-point function, which is one where I think of my torus two-point function, I think of my operator O splitting into two operators that I'll call 1 and 2, and then recombining to form my operator O. So here, this is now a sum over two intermediate operators I've called 1 and 2. Not 1 prime and 2 prime, times the square of the 1, 2, 0 OPE coefficient, times an OPE in this different channel, which for some reason we've called the necklace channel, even though I think that one looks more like a necklace. All right. So what we now want to try and do is understand the transformation from this conformal block in the OPE channel to this conformal block in the necklace channel. And we do that by thinking about the torus two-point function as a Riemann surface with two punctures, and working out how to get that crossing transformation as a product of my elementary crossing kernels. So let's just draw a picture, which is worth 1,000 words. So first, let's think about the necklace channel, what did I call it? The OPE channel. So this is the decomposition in the OPE channel. The first thing I want to do is I want to use the torus one-point crossing. So this looks like a torus with a one-point function. So now I have my operator 1 in the cross channel by doing torus one-point crossing. And what is this? Well, this is just a sphere four-point function where I've sewn together two of the external legs. So now I use a sphere four-point crossing transformation to turn that operator 2 prime into an operator 2. And this then gives me the crossing kernel for this torus two-point modular transformation as a product of a torus one-point crossing kernel and a sphere four-point crossing kernel. So in particular, this crossing kernel, so we could write it, so it depends on these internal operators and one external operator. It's a product of this crossing transformation for one-point functions on the sphere times a crossing transformation for four-point functions on the torus. So here, the external operators from the point of view of the four-point function include my actual external operator, as well as one of my internal operators. And now, the final thing that I need to do in order to extract an asymptotic formula is to go to the limit where the identity operator dominates in this OPE channel. How do I do that? Well, I just take w to 0, and then I take tau to I infinity. And in that case, alpha 1 prime and alpha 2 prime become the identity operator. So in this limit, this becomes S alpha 1 identity. Identity, this is a torus one-point function with an identity as your external operator, times this four-point crossing transformation. But what was this? This is the exact same four-point crossing function that I wrote down before. It's just one factor of the density of states times this OPE asymptotic formula. And what is this? This is the crossing transformation for one-points on the sphere with one of my operators being the identity. That's Cardy's formula. So what do I get? I get now two factors of the density of states rather than just one factor of the density of states times my OPE coefficient. This is the magic of the Morse-Seiberg recipe. I've reduced the crossing transformations for these more complicated observables to those for my simple observables. And we see that because we ended up just gluing on a torus and using one-point crossing on the torus, all we get is an extra factor of the density of states. So this gives us the asymptotic behavior in the limit where one operator is light and the other two are heavy. And indeed, as advertised, it's the exact same formula as we had in the limit where two operators are light and one is heavy. So it's really this Morse-Seiberg construction that is responsible for the universality of this asymptotic formula for OPE coefficients.
Sorry, do you trust that formula if both are large but their difference is finite?
No, they don't need to be. The difference does not need to be finite.
Oh, I understand. But yeah. Do you trust it if it is finite? If you start going to the poles of those...
Good question. I'll need to think about that. That's a good question, actually. Yeah. Good. I think I'm out of time. Maybe I can say 1 minute, and then we can go to question. Can I talk for 1 minute?
Okay.
Okay, I'm just going to... Let me wrap up, and then we can... Okay, great. So you can see that it's this Morse-Seiberg prescription that is responsible for the fact that the same asymptotic formula is true in these three different limits. And although I only went through the torus two-point function discussion here, there's a completely analogous discussion for a genus 2 modular invariance. What do you do there? You replace these pictures by the corresponding ones. We've got some genus 2 Riemann surface here. Okay. Now what you're going to need to do is do the exact same set of moves, but you're going to need to do modular torus one-point crossing twice rather than once. So you're going to get an extra factor of the density of states down here. And that's just reflecting the fact that you're getting the exact same formula for the asymptotic OPE coefficients, but in a heavy, heavy, heavy limit, where we now average over three sets of operators rather than just two sets of operators. So maybe I'll just conclude with a couple of comments that I'll say in words because I'm just out of time. So first of all, this is true at finite central charge. We can take the large central charge limit and reproduce various other results in the literature. I think most of the other comments I had to make were covered in the questions. I'll mention one thing that wasn't covered, which is that the asymptotic formulas that we're discussing here are things that enter as the universal part of the eigenstate thermalization conjecture. So for example, the eigenstate thermalization conjecture says that OPE coefficients between one light operator and two heavy operators can be approximated by thinking of those heavy operators as thermal states. So that the light, heavy, heavy OPE coefficient is basically a thermal one-point function plus a remainder term. And the kinematic part of that remainder term is precisely given by this expression. But the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis is something that we usually believe only in the limit where two operators are heavy and the other operator is light. Whereas we've written down formulas that are true in other regimes, in the light heavy, in the light light heavy, and light heavy, and the heavy 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 regime. So one could then try and speculate that maybe because the formulas that we've written down are true in these other regimes, maybe the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis should be generalized to those regimes as well. That's a kind of strange thing to think about, because the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis sort of has a statistical mechanics interpretation, where you interpret a heavy state as a thermal state, but if you tried to generalize it, say, to heavy, 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 or light, light, heavy regimes, I don't quite have that same statistical mechanics interpretation. But nevertheless, I think that's a very suggestive idea, and I'll stop there. Thank you. Did you want to go first? No.
Yeah, I had a question. So, can you help me resolve this little confusion? So you said Moore and Seibert proved that if you have crossing on the sphere and torus, then that's it. That's already contains all possible constraints for a CFT. Everything else is going to be automatically consistent.
Right.
And then to derive your theorem for light, heavy, heavy, you actually go to other Riemann surfaces. But you said Moore and Seibert proved that other Riemann surfaces, they just don't bring any new information. Yeah. So couldn't you prove your theorem just by working on the sphere and the torus?
I mean, in
a sense, would be logically possible.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, this is a restatement of the Moore-Seibert result. Right? I mean, Moore and Seibert proved that, say, torus two-point crossing is a consequence of torus one-point and sphere four-point crossing. And the implication of that that we're deriving is that the asymptotic formulas that we derive from sphere four-point crossing are the same as the asymptotic formula you get from torus two-point crossing.
It's the same, but it was not a consequence. It was a consequence of something else. You demanded that everything is consistent on a new Riemann surface, and then you derive this formula. But Moore and Seibert tell you that that should be just automatic, so you should be able to see your result just from the sphere and the torus.
If you like, exactly. So I mean, that's a good way of putting it. So I can, what we're saying is we construct the torus two-point function as a sum of sphere four-point functions, right? Because what is this? This is a sphere four-point function, but I've glued these two guys together. Like I could cut this here, and then it would just be a sphere four-point function. I mean, I'm not, I think, I mean.
Well, maybe I'll try to ask later.
I mean, I think this is. Good. There's another Nima or
I have the mic now. So let me ask a technical question. What happens for C less than 25? Is there a problem with the gamma B?
Oh, good, interesting. I don't think so. C less than one is a problem, of course, because there you don't have any heavy primaries to average over. I think there's no problem for C less than 25.
Doesn't B become imaginary?
Yeah, I don't think that's a problem, though.
But the gamma B then has poles on the imaginary axis, where the P is also.
Yeah, but we're working only at very large real P. And so I don't think, I mean, this is a formula that is to be trusted, although I've written down a formula that looks like we should consider it at finite P, as we discussed when Tom was asking his question. I really think of this in the same way that I think about Cardi's formula as a formula that's valid at large P. And the subleading corrections are, these formulas contain one set of subleading corrections, but of course there'll be other subleading corrections.
I guess it was a technical question about the asymptotic behavior of the gamma Bs.
Yeah. I don't see a reason not to trust this at large P, large real P, for C less than 25. And Scott will tell me if I'm wrong. He's nodding, which means I'm wrong. No, he's nodding, which means I might not be wrong.
Sorry. So, question about the comment you just made about the ETH. So in the case where it's light, you don't expect the identity to be dominating, right? Is that the statement? Like, when it's heavy-heavy...
Sorry, when you say it's light...
When it's heavy-heavy, I don't expect ETH in every correlation. So what was the comment you were trying to make?
Well...
Is it just a statement
that... I was careful to say
case?
It was a suggestion, not a proposal. So ETH is the statement... Roughly speaking, that when you take the operators I and J to be very heavy, and O is taken to be some light probe, you think of this as a light probe of a thermal state. So this should be equal to some universal function that depends on O and only the temperature of that state or the energy of that state. So this is basically the torus one-point function, the thermal one-point function. And then there's a subleading piece, which is related to the torus two-point function. And then there's a remainder term, and the sort of meat of the ETH conjecture. I guess meat, okay. It's not a vegetarian-friendly word. The meat of the seitan of the ETH conjecture is the statement that this Rij is a unit-normalized random matrix, or has the statistics of a unit-normalized random matrix. And in particular, this thing here is exponentially suppressed compared to this thing. But this thing is basically what we've computed here. And this thing is that torus one-point function that I mentioned earlier. And so, you know, the interesting speculation is that given that these functions can be generalized to other regimes, or at least this function can be generalized to other regimes, maybe we should think about ETH in these other regimes
but
as well.
It's only like... The general, like you're just saying the identity piece is universal contribution. But
yeah.
If identity is not dominant, I don't expect it.
I might not
okay.
Understand.
Let me ask the following.
Okay.
So you guys isolated the identity contribution, mm-hmm. but in principle you have the formula for any contribution.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, right?
Yeah, it's more complicated, however. I mean, the crossing kernel is much simpler when one of the operators is the identity.
And it is the exact crossing kernel, is that correct? Like mm-hmm. it as a mathematical, forget that it tells you something about CFD.
It's an exact, this is Ponceau and Teschner, we're smart guys. Right?
Yes.
So yes, it's an exact formula for the crossing kernel. And we have some control over the subleading terms. So in particular, the subleading correction to this formula will be exponentially suppressed, just as they are in Cardi's formula. But that statement follows from an analysis of all of the various subleading terms that will enter into crossing of light operators, but not the identity operator. But of course, that's a kind of subtle statement because you need to worry about Tiberian stuff and things like that in order to really bound the behavior of the other operators that would appear in the cross channel.
And the physical pieces of this formula probably look very simple, right? In the sense that you said the subleading terms
yeah.
are not
yeah,
there,
yeah,
so,
yeah.
so there's some simple.
This is the contribution there. Just from the identity operator in the question. I mean, if you wanted to if you wanted to understand, so this is the torus one-point function. If you understand the torus one, the asymptotics of the light heavy OPE coefficients not squared, then you need to consider crossing symmetry of torus one-point functions. And that is dominated not by the identity in the cross-channel, but by some light operator in the cross-channel. So that would be an example of some non-generic asymptotic formula. Okay, should we thank the speaker again?
Thank the speaker again.